Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Josh, what's Power World?
You know what, man? It's funny being more offline than you usually are. I came in this morning.
It's
and
wise,
like,
is what it is.
Listen, we need to do news on Pal World, and I practically had the Metal Gear Solid question mark above my head. I was like, huh? What? What's this thing?
Johnny Sasaki over there, just on the yes. Periphery. But yeah, there'll be a video on the channel about all the things that's going on with Pal World, one of the biggest controversies in gaming emerging as we speak. I did a little news video on it just before, but yeah, that's going to be the conversation probably for the rest of the year, or at least the rest of the month or something, the absolute state of Power World and this weird, potentially AI-generated Pokemon clone that's just made millions of dollars across the weekend.
I better figure out what the hell this thing is then. Best go home after this podcast and do some research.
Oh my God, we should go, because it's on Game Pass for free. Let's play a bit of Power World, mate.
Lad, I've got Baldur's Gate 3 to finish.
Not anymore,
you
haven't.
Justify Power World.
No, you can justify Power World. I've been sacking off Prince of Persia, played a bit of Power World, mate.
Oh man,
Prince of
what
Power
is
World,
this
that's
game?
Me.
What yeah. is this game?
Speaking of games, we started doing our completely subjective Games of the Year ranking from 2023, which allows for ridiculous takes. And we did 10, 9, 8, and 7 last week.
We did.
We got more to get through. I think you had an opening message, though.
Yes, I do. I've got two opening messages.
Yes.
First, on the actual subject, I'm looking over the list that I wrote last week. And do you ever, like, look at something you've written and just think, was I on crack cocaine when I did this? You know what I mean? Like, was I having a breakdown? Was I in, like,
having
a coma or something? Because I still stand by this list. Of course I do. But it's one of those where I think, in a year's time, am I going to look back and think, what was I thinking?
Yeah, where's
what
the actual final bar line?
But that's the beauty of... Shut up. No.
Shut up.
But that's the beauty of these lists, because like you said last week, these are entirely subjective, and I'm just kind of basing them off vibes as much as I am proper analysis. But also, yeah, before I get into this, I also... The person I'm talking about probably won't even listen to this, but I had a lovely weekend down Manchester seeing a band called Spanish Love Song.
Shout.
And I got talking in the gig to a lovely person called Alec, and I had a nice conversation with them. But there was also someone else who came over, but I was washing my hands at the time, and I got a bit stressed because my hands were dripping wet.
Like,
and I feel like I was more rude to them because I was a little bit overwhelmed in the toilets then. So I just want to say, sorry, it was also lovely to meet you, if you're even listening. You're probably not.
We're doing the old Peter Porker thing at the start of Spider-Verse, where you just come up with a watery hand and just go, it's fine, just shake it, it's fine.
I didn't want to be like that. I was like, no one wants to touch these hands right now. Yeah, I just wanted to throw that out there on the off chance someone's listening.
But... Massive shout to anyone who's listening, to be honest, but we'll do the rest of our games of the year. We'll see how far we get through this. Maybe we'll get through the whole thing, in theory. So we're counting down 6 through 1. I do want to recap, though. My number 10 was Like a Dragon, Guy Den, The Man Who Erased His Name. My number 9 was Gravity Circuit, and my number 8 was Theatrhythm Final Bar Line, with my number 7 being Alan Wake 2.
My number 10 was Lies of P. My number 9 was Amnesia the Bunker. My number 8 was Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. And my number 7, where I left off, was Marvel's Spider-Man 2.
Beautiful. My number 6 is Baldur's Gate 3.
Is that right?
Take it.
Is it?
Take it Baldur's and run with it, my
Gate
friend.
Comes later for me, but tell me why it's 6. That's another one after Alan Wake that is way lower down than I expected from you.
If we're doing the subjectivo, then I love my time with Baldur. The thing is, we're splitting hairs for the next 6 games. These are all games that I absolutely adored. These are the ones that had a smile plastered across my face the entire way through. Baldur's Gate 3, like I said, when I did the actual like sites rundown, it was number 1 for the Wacol Game of the Year thing. It clearly is the best game of 2023.
Is it though?
I would say so, but then I would also say something else. But I think for boulders, it just is so incredibly impressive. Everyone who's touched it at this point will know exactly why, just the sheer amount of permutations you can get to every single quest, every single decision that you make. The thing that I absolutely loved about it was the way that it kind of came back around in Act 3. I notoriously, as I covered in the spoiler cast with myself and Adam Strawn, largely missed Act 2. Because I thought it was a big dungeon and I was in the dark and I went and did some, I'm not going to do spoilers, but I went to like specific map markers. I did some big quests, had a nice little time, but I didn't flesh out the map. I didn't realize it was a whole map. I thought it was just a dark dungeon to get through. So I kind of went from Act 1 and then did some stuff and then went to Act 3 and spent like 40 hours in each act kind of thing. And I kind of missed all the middle stuff. But my point is, I love that the game was able to course correct and still give me a phenomenal ending and character arcs and everything else. So I love my time with Baldur's Gate 3. I didn't realize I was missing all that stuff, like the last light in and everything, until way after. But it just is the reactions that the game has to you, the fact that it is so reactive, and it made me miss old school BioWare RPG design. And it just made me treasure the fact that it exists. I'm so happy that we live in a time where this game exists.
Yeah, man, I fully back that. You know, I got to Baldur's Gate 3 very late. I've only been playing it over the course of this month. I've still not finished it, despite being 80 hours in. And I think it's funny what you say about Act 2 there, because that's where it didn't click for me there, but that's where I realized it was going to get higher and higher on my list, because I was just loving it more and more as Act 2 developed and I started exploring that map, just because the game itself took a little while for me to fully get to grips with, because honestly, it's kind of not my thing on paper. The reason I waited until January is that despite the great reviews, I wasn't sure if I would like it because on the one hand, it's a CRPG, which I'm not against, but I don't have much experience with. I'm not too familiar with kind of how they work, really. I've played two in my entire life. You know, I've played the original Fallout, a bit of Fallout 2, and then Disco Elysium, which this is very different from. It's Dungeons and Dragons, which again, I know literally nothing about. Like, I don't even know the bare basics.
Me neither, really.
Of that world. And it's obviously, you know, a tabletop game, so you've got all of these numbers and stats and such.
He hates the dice.
Which, again, I'm not familiar with. So it was a sort of something I was coming into with a little bit of hesitation, and yet it completely won me round by the end. And even in the first few hours, I kind of knew it was something special. It was just getting to grips with the turn-based combat. How am I supposed to be treating the party system and leveling up? What can I do? How is the world going to react to it? All of that jazz. And it was kind of like getting into Act 2. I was comfortable with everything by then. So I could just kind of go with it and indulge in it. And it kind of makes me want to go back to Act 1 and kind of do it fresh with knowing how the game functions, if that makes sense.
Totally. That was one of the things that I did with this was I started, I think it's like an elf or something, and then realized I was way in over my head in regards to the lore and the various references that were being made to past wars that had happened and events and stuff. And I was like, I don't know this lore at all.
Yeah.
So I kind of just like thought like through the BioWare mindset where I was like, I'm going to restart and just play as a human and I can ask all the questions I need to ask. As like, I'll just role play as someone who has landed in this land and doesn't know anything about what's going on. And I found that worked a lot better and lined it up with like a Mass Effect 1 kind of feeling of like you're in this new you know, place with all these different races and everything. You can ask everything. We can talk more about Baldur's Gate 3 when we get to it because it'll be in your top six somewhere.
It will.
I assume. So what's your number six, please?
My number six is Star Wars Jedi Survivor.
What a beautiful game.
And it...
Eventually.
You know what? This was number two, I think, when we did the mid-year check-in, which feels like a lifetime ago now. By the way, and it's unfortunately been knocked down because there have been so many great games that came out in the second half of last year, but Jedi Survivor still has a fond place in my heart because, yes, we've talked to death about it being broken, and I can't excuse that. It's just that I happen to have a much better time with it than most people. The only time it really broke for me was when I jumped into water and then the frame rate completely tanked. But otherwise, it was stable. And I've said it so many times that it's almost becoming a Josh Brown What Culture Gaming soundboard. But Jedi Survivor to me is how to make a sequel. You know, this is coming ahead of Marvel's Spider-Man 2, which I also loved. Similarly to you, pretty much everything on this list is kind of splitting hairs to certain degrees. But this gets above Spider-Man 2 because of how much it innovates on the original. This really feels like the next step for the franchise. It's more confident. It's more well-rounded. It's more polished in terms of the mechanics, certainly not in terms of the tech. And yeah, it just leveled up everything I liked about the original, mm-hmm. which I thought was, you know, a really solid, surprising 8 out of 10 experience, and ratcheted it up to a 9 out of 10 experience. I couldn't believe how much I was engaged with the story, the characters. It's amazing what a beard can do. You put it on Cal Kestis and suddenly he's the coolest guy in the whole world. And I love the customization you could you were allowed over him as well to kind of personalize your Cal in a way that you couldn't in the original game. Lightsaber combat, silky smooth, cool next-gen visuals, a much broader scope than I was expecting, cool Metroidvania elements. Love this game, man. Really sold me on the franchise as a whole.
Yeah, man. Well, that was my thing. Yeah, that's definitely the takeaway thing for me. I was like, you're one of the only people doing Star Wars well. Like, as an IP that is so just dead, like just dead. Like every now and then it twitches a bit, and we all kind of look at it and go, "Look, it's moving again."
Hey, there's a Mandalorian movie coming out.
Is there? Like, I mean, whatever. Like, for me, like it's like the only bright sparks in the last few years have been Andor and this. Like, that's it. And it's like, but the way that they get it so right, where they do have one foot in the kind of in the Andorian approach, like how much of a intimidating the Empire is, but then they also have another foot in the prequel stuff, where it's like the creature feature stuff and like funny accents and ridiculous stuff that's coming out of these different aliens, and you guys have fun with that as well. I feel like there's a way to walk that line that the movies haven't figured out, or the TV shows haven't really figured out either, that Respawn nail in this.
Yeah.
And that's before you even get to how well it plays and how good the level design is. And like you said, it's like this really perfect 3D Metroidvania, which like hardly anyone ever gets right.
Yeah.
In a way that like on the map screen like conveys like, hey, you might want to check this area out again, but without telling you exactly what you're going to find there. And it's always rewarding. And it's like you said, they improve on everything from the original, the customization, and the writing of Cal made me miss like gritty sequels.
Yeah.
It was such an era where it was like Prince of Persia, Warrior Within, and Jak 2, and even Mass Effect 2. There was the kind of a return to that where like I thought it rounded his character out nicely, where he had a bit more of an edge to him, without it being like too like grimdark or whatever. And like, yeah, I like enjoyed the majority of my time with this game. It's just as I rambled on loads across 2023, the negatives were very negative. But the game now, it took 8 official patches to do it.
It did.
And they had to put a statement out saying they fundamentally rebuilt the engine to make the performance mode work.
Is that right?
Yeah. And it's like, but it does now work 4K 60, or at least it's 60 frames a second with I think it's an uncapped frame rate. Beautiful, beautiful game. Like, it just took, it was a weird release rollout for it. I hope it doesn't affect the next ones, to be honest.
Me too. They can't do this for a third time. They couldn't really do it for a second time because, you know, Jedi Fallen Order was notoriously buggy at launch as well. Mm-hmm. So just give it an extra 6 months if you need Respawn, because you've got something beautiful there. Mm-hmm. And it sucks that, rightly so, you know, the conversations are always about people getting, you know, a version of the game at launch that doesn't justify the price tag, because it's a shame if all those things were ironed out. I think this would have been talked about way more than it was. I think the most impressive thing to me about it is that, unlike Spider-Man 2, which again, I really love, it's on my list, I thought it had such great precision at pinpointing what didn't work about the original and either omitting it entirely or transforming those elements to make them fun. You know, playing Fallen Order again just before this sequel came out, I was kind of taken aback at how many kind of mistakes and drawbacks were in that game, especially surrounding the puzzles and exploration. And Jedi Survivor just cuts out all of that with surgical precision. It knows what was good about the original and knows what was bad about it, and it doubles down on the good stuff. And I've not seen a sequel do that in a long time.
No, also, like, one of the things I loved about Fallen Order was the very end of it, when you actually had all the powers so far.
Yeah.
And it was like, just like, you have that final level, you're infiltrating like an underwater base and you're just flinging stormtroopers everywhere and having fun comboing stuff together. I always love when a sequel takes off from exactly where you left off, and this thing gives you that sort of like power fantasy side of being a Jedi, where it's like picking up a dude that has like a minigun and aiming him at everyone else so you can take everybody out, and thinking through encounters in a way that's almost like Doom, where it's like, well, this guy has this buff and this guy does this. I feel like they know what they've got, and they, like, in a way that they didn't with Fallen Order. I think they were still kind of figuring it out. It was like Respawn's first third person game.
Yeah, man.
And it's with this, yeah, like it's a perfect sequel. Again, it's a shame about the performance stuff, but I think we should draw a line under that stuff. Like, if you're picking the game up now, you get a phenomenal version of it, and it's by far the best version of it that's out there. I don't know how long it's going to take them for a part 3, but I love the feel of this when it clicks. And
yes,
nothing else really felt like this. Like, it's taken from a bit of Souls, it's taken from a bit of Devil May Cry. Like, it's a really good midpoint.
It really is. You know, like, the first game, perhaps controversially, kind of leaned a little bit too heavy into the sort of Souls-style structure. You know, it was a bit more demanding, combat was a little less aggressive and you kind of had to be more patient, which kind of did make sense for where Cal was in that journey.
True.
But yeah, I think they hit a nice midpoint here where there's still a lot of thought that needs to be put into the combat, and it rewards, you know, really thinking tactically, like you said, about the enemies you're facing and which powers, which lightsaber stances will benefit you. Mm. But it has that kind of fastness and fluidity to it and impact that, like you said, you know, is more evocative of something like Devil May Cry. And they just managed to find the sweet spot where you kind of, it is its own combat system now in a way that the original arguably wasn't, but it was still, you know, good for it.
Also, like, to just round it out, like, some of my favorite Star Wars moments were in this. Like, there's not to do like necessarily plot spoilers, but in terms of an appearance, Darth Vader is in this.
Yeah,
and it's like he's so played out, like, and it's just it's too much of an easy, too easy of a thing to keep leaning on in wider Star Wars media. Hey, by the way, he was actually in the background of this scene and like whatever, but they actually use him well. And I'm not going to say how, but I didn't expect what they did with him. And I think it's like I haven't seen any other piece of Star Wars media in the modern age have that much confidence with a legacy character in the overall way that he's used, and I they found a way to make him benefit, you know, everything else.
Honestly, man, just their confidence in their characters generally, like I said, you know, coming off the end of the first game, there were the characters that they introduced, original and some legacy characters, you know, I was interested in, but I wouldn't, you know, die for them. Whereas this time around, every character that returned, they just managed to make them that bit more interesting, that have that bit more depth, have more impact on the story overall. And it meant that characters that I wasn't too asked about initially, I suddenly found myself loving or hating them, depending on how they were utilizing the story, but intentionally so, because of the quality of the writing and the quality of the performances.
Mm-hmm. Plus, it's the Mass Effect 2 thing of like being reintroduced to the squad. Yes. And it's like, that's like a fun energy. My number five is Street Fighter 6.
Oh!
A game that I don't think you played.
I didn't. You know, there were...
It's a perfect game, Josh.
Here's the thing, you know, before I let you just wax lyrical about how great this game was, there were so many from last year, like I said initially, that I just didn't play that I wanted to, and Street Fighter 6 among so many others are ones that I knew would be on lists like this, and I kind of wish I had some context for, but please tell me why this game is your number five.
Well, the thing is, like, I think it's the best that Street Fighter has ever been. Like, a lot of people talk about Street Fighter 2. Obviously, people talk about Street Fighter 2. It was the big landmark release. I feel like Street Fighter is sometimes in the shadow of 2 quite a lot. 4 was a big return to form in the late 2000s, and then 5 was an absolute tire fire for a good couple of years before they put all the modes back in. And then it was like 6 needed to be what people expect when they think of Street Fighter. It's such a known term. Everyone's heard of Street Fighter. It's like, how are you not delivering quality alongside that? And 6, I said this when we did I think it was the Games of the Year so far, or maybe it was just a general conversation last year, but it's such a like refined beast of a game. It's so perfect, like frame perfect game. I love the learning curve. I love the little things that are in here to help people get on board with Street Fighter. Like, there's a lot of like assist modes and auto combo stuff and ways to help you get used to a fighter and get you in that mindset of, which I never cared about before, frame data. And I'm still not that guy yet, but I care more about it now than I ever did before. And I think it's because it is kind of learning that sort of chess mentality thing that is at the heart of like fighting tournaments. And it got me watching more esports, fighting game esports that I ever have before, and really caring about like the distance that a certain move will go. And like, just I think that technical side of it is that upper echelon of like Street Fighter play or fighting game play. And hardly any fighting games actually like encourage you to care.
Yeah.
Like Injustice 2 had frame data stuff in it, and Mortal Kombat does as well. But it's just overall, Street Fighter 6 is such a perfect package. I like the single player mode. It's fun enough. It's kind of like a Tekken 4 style brawler thing. More of just like a wider, like it is an open world, but it's quite a small world beat 'em up thing. But the meat and potatoes, the actual fighting is just so effing fluid. Like, it just goes. I love the art style and the music and everything as well. I know you weren't big on that, but I think that's a big part of why I absolutely fell in love with it. Like, I love the character designs, and it's just, you just feel so awesome playing it. And obviously when you fight online, standard fighting game online stuff, you're gonna get pasted. But if you manage to overcome that and you come back with all these new mechanics, like being able to tank hits and like run through someone's hit, and then you get the win because you get the hit. And it's like, those little clutch moments are why fighting games are so tight and awesome. And so one of my favorite favorite genres, and this just is the best one. Like, it was in a year, you know, initially where like Tekken 8 was going to be out last year. I think it was maybe last year, but obviously we had Mortal Kombat 1. I would say MK1 was a huge disappointment, especially towards the end of the story, and it's only gone on to be like pretty insulting in regards to how much they've monetized it. £20 skins, £25 skins.
So fascinated to jump into that game. Finally.
I feel like I called it. Like I said, right. Like MK is the only Warner Brothers property that has positive, you know, like a positive aura around it, and they'll monetize the living F out of it. And that's exactly what they've done. Mm. Like the end of that game story, without going into specifics or spoilers, is fundamentally a, hey, remember the online live mode we've got? Do you want to go buy some skins? Do you want to go do you want to get some loot components? Like,
right.
It's horrible. And it's like, they have a whole endless, I hate what they did with MK1. Mm. And it started so well, and it's so good for like 3/4 of that story. And then it just feels like the money men came in and just said, hey, can you just sort of pivot that into the endless mode and we'll just charge people for the rest of it?
Wow.
Bad. But anyway, Street Fighter 6, especially next to that, is this resounding example of how to do a fighting game. Street Fighter 6 does have its problems with overpriced skins as well, but there's so much to love. It's perfect.
No, I think it's, you know, anything I think should be commended that gets people really into an entire genre. Baldur's Gate 3 did that for me with CRPGs and even Dungeons & Dragons, but anything that can turn you from... I'm not saying you were a casual fan by any means, but say anything that can turn you from a more casual fighting fan and get you interested in that, like you said, upper echelon of the genre and have you thinking about elements of the genre that you previously maybe overlooked or didn't want to engage with because they seemed so intimidating. Mm. I certainly have that issue with fighting games as a whole. Mm-hmm. I think that is a spectacular feat to put off. If you can appeal to both like the mainstream casual fighting fans who just want to feel good and feel powerful and watch some amazingly designed characters fight it out, if you can appeal to them while also, you know, creating a more hardcore experience that people who will live and breathe the online modes for can also cherish, I think it's difficult. You don't see many fighting games pull that off. Even Street Fighter V had that issue when that released. And the fact that they managed to do that in a complete package, like you said, even as someone who hasn't played it and is only looking from afar, like I think it was so cool to see the response to it last year.
Yeah, and it's like I went into 2023 and overall I'm a Mortal Kombat fan. It's my favorite fighting franchise, and then Tekken and then Street Fighter or whatever. And I came out of last year going, it's Street Fighter. Mm. Like like next to each other, Street Fighter 6 is just infinitely better than Mortal Kombat, at least from my point of view. Your number five, please.
My number five is a game that I'm not going to talk about too much because I've talked to you about it to death in podcasts last year. I even did a 15-minute editorial on it, which I
was going to guess
recommend
it.
You check out. Yes. But what do you think it is?
Well, it can't be Wanted Dead. I think it's Stay Out of the House.
It is Stay Out of the House. Wait. My number five is Stay Out of the House, the puppet combo first-person horror game that I absolutely adored and kind of defined the early period of 2023 for me. This got me interested in a whole publisher and all of the games they had released because its flavor of throwback PS1 style aesthetics. You know, everything is polygonal. Everything is there's like short draw distances, which kind of fits because you're walking around, or more aptly, crawling around and crouching around this dark house that you have no idea what it's full of. That's not a sentence, but you know what I mean. You have no idea what's around the next corner. You have no idea what that screeching is coming down the hallway. And all of the limitations, purposeful limitations of, you know, PS1 style games are implemented here in a purposeful way to kind of etch up the horror and really extend it beyond, you know, its visuals, which are intentionally rudimentary, right?
Rule.
Yeah, I think they absolutely rule. It's just an aesthetic that I adore. Some people might not be able to get over that because it might just seem very dated to them, which is fair enough. But in terms of horror experiences, this is absolutely living alongside Amnesia the Bunker for me in terms of the most memorable. And they're actually very similar games, which I think I covered in the last podcast we did on it, in terms of you're being chased around a more or less a single environment with a bunch of different other interiors branching off from it by a persistent enemy. You have a revolver that you have to chamber each individual bullet for that you can use to either solve puzzles or to scare off the monster itself. And just that game of cat and mouse, I think both games nail. But Stay Out the House, I think, has a slightly better story, a slightly more interesting aesthetic. Mm-hmm. And like I said, just has that extra element of intensity and scariness that I very much appreciate.
Yeah, man. Well, the thing is, I only played, it's like in, I think there's four parts to it or three.
Yeah.
But you do, like, I remember downloading it and I did the first couple of parts of it. The thing that ended up making me not finish it was just how much progress I was losing trying to explore the house and getting caught, which was the same problem I had with Alien Isolation, but that's kind of just the genre to some degree. And it definitely works for being terrified of you're about to be found or something. But overall, like, I love this kind of like run of like throwback horror that we're getting. I love the idea that a PS1 aesthetic is a specific choice and not a technical limitation. And yeah, it's like, in this, they have a bunch of like visual filters and things like that. You can turn them off and it looks really weird. It looks like an emulated old game or something, but you're better off leaving them on.
Yeah.
And just trying to have this almost VCR style approach to the visuals and the aesthetic and everything. Yeah, this was a game that I would never even know about if you hadn't played it. And it was like, I came to like love and really appreciate the overall feel of it. And I haven't checked anything else the Puppet Combo have done, but I'd love to see more of it. I just want to see more of them take this and run with it.
Yeah.
And give me something where I'm not going to lose too much progress getting caught. But I do, it's like, especially the opening stuff, which is a weird thing to point out. I think we covered it on one of the podcasts last year, where you're playing as like a retail worker, you're in like a gas station, and it's like, oh, is that a car following me in the car park and everything? And the way that thing plays out is just a really cool, pretty unique horror scenario for
it
a
is.
Game.
No, it's so different from the game to come as well. Like, that is the prologue, and you might play it and expect a more scripted walking simulator style horror where you don't have much agency over the gameplay itself, and the scares will just happen on a kind of scripted routine. But the actual meat and potatoes of the game isn't that, but it makes that opening more memorable because it is so different. Sets the tone and it establishes the story and gives you a fright in a way that you might not have experienced previously. I think it's the intro especially is more of a slow burn, not to drop her in it, but obviously I was recommending this to everyone last year, including your friend of mine, Ash Millman, and I know she didn't take to the opening as much as we did,
really?
But she ended up loving the game overall.
Okay.
But yeah.
I'll cancel the hits, Josh.
There's so many elements to it that I just love that you can have those takeaways. You can say, yeah, I love the introduction, but maybe didn't like the epilogue or, you know, variations of the different experiences that are held within there. I just couldn't believe how ambitious it was overall.
Also, like, me and you talk quite a lot about there's a certain thing about the restrictions that were around in the PS1 era for horror, whether that be tank controls, camera angles, certain designs, like certain faces, certain demonic faces, like some stuff just looks more scary when it's pixelated or when it's de-resed or whatever it is. And obviously I like that they steer into that with this. Like, there is something about this barely rendered being coming after you that it's some sometimes can be more scary. And obviously the sound design in this thing is immaculate.
Yeah.
And it's just like, yeah, I love, like, as we're in 2024, we're getting to that era where it's like, why not make a PS1 horror? Like, just because we moved on from it on a technical standpoint doesn't mean you can't do a PS1 style horror, an N64 style horror. I like that as an overall, just the reality of like what gamers, developers are going for.
I'm really interested. And if anyone fits this criteria, I'd love for you to message us on X. Actually, no, I won't see it on X. Message me on Instagram if you do have an answer. But I'm interested in if this works for a generation that didn't grow up with like PS1 or older PC games, because I think it would work for me if I didn't have that context, but so much of it comes from almost nostalgic memories of being frightened of similar, monsters, whether it's the zombies from Resident Evil 1 and 2, which, you know, have that kind of pixelatedness to them that probably wouldn't be scary if you just saw them now. But in my mind, they're so ingrained as part of my formative foray into horror that this manages to tap back into that and make them scary again. So I am interested in if it only is scary if you have that experience in that context, or if it just works as a bloody good thrill ride regardless.
It's a weird line to walk. I would shout out the, is it the Atlanteans from the end of Tomb Raider? Those yes. weird like snake-headed things. Yeah. They were very annoying. I think we said this last week, but I think for the rest of our top four, I don't think either of us have game. I don't think we share a single game here. But I guess we'll see.
Maybe one, but certainly not the rest.
I'll be amazed if you have anything that I've got in my top four. My number four is Metroid Prime Remastered.
Oh, which was hell.
Just a beautiful little game, which like in years gone by wouldn't have qualified. And it didn't qualify for the overall What Culture Top 15.
Right.
If I'm able to play the subjectivity card.
Listen, I'm going to allow it. You know, I mean, you fought me tooth and nail on Crash Bandicoot Insane Trilogy a few years ago. But I'm going to draw a line to that. Water under the bridge, I'd say. Bring on the remasters.
Now we're finally even.
Yeah.
A few years later. Yeah, I mean, the thing is with Metroid Prime Remastered, obviously the original, I think 2003, I forget the year it came out. But I never really played it back then. I had a friend who played it, and every time I'd go to his house, I'd see little bits of it. But I never had it myself. And it was just a game that I knew about the franchise. Like, I mean, I absolutely effing love Metroid, like, but it's 2D Metroid. I hadn't spent any time properly with the Prime series. And yeah, going through it, I was like, one, it looks absolutely gorgeous. Like, it really looks better than any other Switch game. Like,
yeah.
All the little details that are in there, that some of them were in the original, but it's like raindrops on Samus's helmet, like some of the reflections on the cannon. Just little things that, like, really immerse you in it. The sound design's phenomenal. We talk about, like, Metroidvania level design and how hard it is to nail it in 3D. Obviously, Prime is a big deal because they always got that right. And just bringing that into the new age, like, I don't have the one-to-one knowledge of the original, but this felt like a modern Metroid Prime. This just felt like a really super playable, just really fun to explore and really fun boss battles, really cool combat design, like a lock-on based combat model where you're dancing around everybody, taking loads of enemies out and everything. And the power-ups that you get are really, really cool. Everyone knows what Metroid Prime is at this point, but it's just a perfect version of that. And I had an absolute blast going through it. I will also shout out, which is hilarious, Linkin Park. I got massively back into Linkin Park when I was playing this game.
Oh, right. I was trying to figure out how that was going to connect there. I thought, did they do the soundtrack?
You unlock Mike Shinoda. You've just got to get to the right area. But you know when you play a game, I don't know if you ever did this, where you get into an album or a series of albums when you're playing a game, and they just lock in. And it's like, I had Metroid Prime on for the most part, but every now and then when I was like backtracking or whatever, I'd have Linkin Park on. And it just made me realize, I don't know how many other people out there have had this realization. Linkin Park were brilliant, to be honest. Like, obviously the albums that blew up when we were kids were like Hybrid Theory, Meteora. A lot of people dropped off around Minutes to Midnight, and everyone hated Living Things and everything that came after that. And A Thousand Suns. But I just played all of them when I was going back through it. I just wanted to shout that out. Linkin Park, brilliant.
I love that, man. And I absolutely have albums that I associate with certain games. Mm-hmm. The first one that comes to mind for me is Green Day's Dookie with Battlefield 3. Like, I used to listen to that, which I would never do now because I want to hear the footsteps of the enemy players. But I would listen to that, like, more or less on repeat while I was just going through multiplayer match after multiplayer match. And I love it when you can synergize.
I can't mention Metroid Prime Remastered without thinking about Linkin Park. Nice. It was just what was on there the whole time. Their Thousand Suns album is like a masterpiece. And it was like, when we were all kids, you know how when they started changing their sound and it was like they started doing more electronic stuff and they started singing more cleanly and they got away from the screaming stuff that was in Hybrid Theory. And a lot of us, when we were kids, we were angsty teens and everything. We didn't like it. We wanted you to be angry again.
Right.
And they did that on the Hunting Ground album and it was fine. But like all the stuff where they were experimenting with cleaner vocals and different song structures and whatever, if you go back to that now, brilliant. Like, because it's like, I remember the whole thing that Jenova Chen said, the dude from Journey, who was like, mature art will age with you.
Yeah.
And there's something you can get out of something later on in life. Not that Linkin Park is the most mature thing in the world, but I would totally recommend those middle albums that you probably swore off when you were younger. Thousand Suns is awesome.
I've never listened to a Linkin Park album. Maybe I will
now.
What
do you mean? What?
No, not even. You have to remember, I'm a little bit younger than you.
A little bit, but Hybrid Theory was a thing.
I heard the singles off there. Of course, I loved, you know, every Linkin Park single I loved back in the day. But yeah, for whatever reason, never got into the albums. Was more into Green Day and Blink-182 and then later on Fall Out Boy. So yeah, Linkin Park and the sort of what I would class as, it's not necessarily, you know, hard, but it's harder rock than what I was listening to at the time. So I never actually listened to any albums. And everyone always talks about Hybrid Theory, and I of course know the big hits off there, but I've never listened to it all the way through.
Hybrid Theory is always their go-to. That was one that obviously blew them up so much. But yeah, your friend of mine, Adam Nicholas, we had a love-in on how much we love Linkin Park, and he'd also been going through the later albums. And I was like, there's something about the age that we're at where you get retrospective about what back in the day with Linkin Park. Metroid Prime Remaster, my number four.
I'm going to just quickly add one thing to Metroid Prime Remastered, because I haven't played it, but you know how I'm always cry-arsing about the Switch and its lack of power? That was a game where it made me reconsider. And I'd only seen, you know, clips that you'd posted or if you were playing it in the office. And I thought, man, that thing looks absolutely spectacular.
Sure.
And do you think, you know, it's kind of going to set the blueprint for Metroid Prime 4 whenever that eventually releases? Because it almost seems like it's established a high bar, even if it is just a remaster or maybe more aptly a remake of an older game.
Yeah, you'd hope so. I mean, according to Jeff Grubb from a few years ago, they'd always intended to remaster the whole trilogy, and apparently Metroid Prime 2 and 3 have already been remade as well or whatever, but not in as much as the first one. This felt like a whole reskin. Like, there's lots of side-by-sides. It's a really impressive reskin. But yeah, you'd want to hope that this is like a new benchmark. I mean, yeah. I now think Metroid Prime 4 has been pushed back so much that it's going to be a showcase of whatever the next Switch is. So I wonder if it'll be even more impressive. But yeah, it's exactly what you think it is in terms of it's exactly what you want from a solid remaster. You could argue it's a remake, but it's just super playable. And I love the level design. I love playing as Samus. I just thoroughly enjoyed my time with it.
Nice, man. Well, yeah. It's funny because you cannot say this next game was what everyone wanted that's on my list, because number four for me is Starfield.
Ooh.
And it's not hilarious, because I bloody love Starfield, obviously, but it was strange to come back to this job, right? Having taken my break, of course, a week after Starfield came out, and we had that podcast where we talked about it and how we were both really enjoying it.
We're the only two fans of this entire game.
Well, this is it. And then realizing when I came back how the tide had completely turned, and seeing it get all of these overwhelmingly negative responses. And that kind of took me by surprise, because I thought, well, I bloody love this game. I thought this was really good. What am I getting out of it that other people aren't? So I watched the Nakey Jakey video on Bethesda's game designers outdated, I think the title is called. And I love Nakey Jakey stuff, man. Same. Like, that guy is so funny. He's so good with his analysis. But I think it's interesting, because he's done three or four of those. He did Rockstar's game design is outdated.
Naughty Dog's
game design is outdated. And now Bethesda's game design is outdated. And it's not that I don't disagree with his analysis. It's just that, like, the stuff he's talking about kind of isn't important to me. And it kind of made me realize, okay, this is why a lot of people don't like the game. But I like it for other reasons almost.
Same.
You know, I can totally see his criticisms and many other people's criticisms about how empty space feels, how if you land on a planet, you know, you're not going to find much in the way of original content to kind of justify it. Walking across planets itself is a slog. Like, I agree with all of this stuff. The loading screens between everything gets old fast. But the joy that I got out of that game was separated from all of that. The joy that I got out of exploring was incredible for me, because, yeah, while those planets were barren, the planets that I felt like I was pointed towards had so much content. Like, I remember a moment where I just landed on this colony in the first galaxy, I think, that you arrive at. And it's kind of like this historical monument almost. It's like the rest of space has passed it by. And this was the first settlement that the people of Earth ever established. And it was just like this, not hidden, but it wasn't like signposted. And I spent hours and hours there, you know what I mean? And I just kept finding things like that where I would
land.
You've
been on Mars for like 40 hours.
Yeah, I was on Mars for ages, man. I wouldn't move on from Mars.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
And I, for whatever reason, managed to find like all of this depth. And I was very lucky in that fact, in a way, because I spent a lot of hours initially not finding any depth at all,
which is
totally valid. But yeah. When I did find the content, as it were, it all clicked for me, man. It all worked.
I can only echo that. Like, I totally get the thing is, like, we said this back when we first started covering it. There is that argument of like, okay, you have, I forget what their number was for the amount of planets they have in total, like 8,000 or something. It was a lot. I don't want the majority of them to be populated or filled with hashtag content or whatever, because it gets away from the idea of a vastness of space. And I get that that's a weird thing to grapple with, and I totally get people bouncing off it, but it's why No Man's Sky is a similar thing. It should feel like an unconquerable galaxy. It should feel vast, and it should feel like you can get lost in it, and it should feel like you might touch down and not get something specifically curated, and it should feel, and it is a weird thing, because it's like, I like this facet of the game design, but I totally, again, I get why people would be annoyed by it, but the fact that you could just get stranded on a planet and walk for 20 minutes, that to me still works. To the idea of being an explorer and the escapism side of that. And No Man's Sky always give you a bit more to do. I do think that Starfield's surveillance mechanics, or whatever you call them, the archival stuff where you're trying to take photos of animals and things like that, are a bit crap. They don't even give you much of a ping to let you know you've banked stuff. Whereas No Man's Sky was always better with that. But still, like you said, like when you stumble upon something, it's awesome. A lot of the curated or authored content in the game is brilliant. And it's like some of the best characters that Bethesda have ever written. It's just like, and I had a great time with that. And it's not that I spent my time doing all the barren planet stuff. I spent most of my time doing specific side missions and main missions. But it just works. Like, I get the people who wandered off the beaten path and didn't find anything. But for whatever reason, the way that game saved itself up to me, it completely worked. Like, I think that what is there is brilliant.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. You know, there was more or less a moment where I decided to stop going to random planets, which right. You could argue you shouldn't have to make that decision after
the UI
10 hours of fumbling around.
Well.
Oh, yeah, don't get me wrong. There's so many problems with the game. But yeah, once I was on that kind of track and I kind of understood where I need to go to find the good stuff, as it were, it just kept serving up good stuff to the point where I was 80 hours in and I was still finding brand new settlements with all of these different characters to meet and stuff like that. And I do like the variation on display. I like that, and I'm so sorry because I've not played it since September, but I've forgotten the planet. But the planet that's essentially like Fallout New Vegas, it's the old Westy place. And I didn't get there for like 50 hours or something. It took me a long time before I reached that environment. And then it was just a joy because I thought, man, this is so different from what I've experienced so far. Mm-hmm. All of these characters are so cool. I like the setup of this world. And yeah, man, all of that just made for a really memorable experience. I totally understand that if you're wanting a space exploration game first and foremost, I can totally see why it's disappointing. I think that's absolutely valid. For me though, I was going for like a Fallout 4 style Bethesda RPG, and I kind of got that in spades.
I love building my ship. I actually really love, my favorite thing about the game was the way that it ended. I'm not gonna do spoilers here, but I love the overall message. I love their whole dissection of what is an explorer hoping to achieve, and the way that they sort of gamify that, like to keep it really, really vague, because not anybody's finished this thing when you look at the trophy data and everything. Or the achievement data. But like, yeah, I still thought it had a really good through line punch, and I at the end of it really worked for me. I like the decisions that you make, like everything paid off, like every character arc that I'd embarked on paid off, like the romance option I picked paid off. Like, I had a great time with Starfield. Like, yeah. I totally get the people who don't like it, but I think, you know, focusing on the fact that the animation that you do when you unlock a star power is the movement you do is the same every time, and then saying, well, the whole game sucks because of that, I think that misses 99% of why it's brilliant.
Yeah, I think I'd agree. I think it is sort of easy to get bogged down in that stuff because there is so much of, like, fluff and, you know, jank, you know, that we... yeah. have kind of
moved. Well, they just did a huge patch in December. So,
did they? Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I would like to go back. I think for me, the only reason it's not higher, because it absolutely ticks a bunch of my boxes, especially aesthetically. I love that kind of NASA punk, I think they described it as. That to me is a... And it's a cringy term, but visually in the way it's executed, I like that kind of brand of sci-fi. It doesn't get higher on the list, and it certainly doesn't beat out another RPG I'm going to get to, because I kind of was disappointed with the main story. I thought it was, me, it was a little undercooked. I felt like I wasn't making many interesting decisions. I liked it from a story perspective and a beat-by-beat script perspective, but in terms of actual gameplay, I found it underwhelming in its set pieces and its big moments. I thought, like, as an RPG, I was totally underwhelmed. I thought every decision that I made in the game felt like a little bit flat. I've kind of had to accept that Bethesda's just not going to give me that deep RPG experience anymore. They're more focused on exploration and leveling up and interacting with characters, but not in a way where you can make, like, Fallout New Vegas style decisions, or Disco Elysium style decisions, or Baldur's Gate 3 decisions. And it was still underwhelming to see them move away from that when I thought they might double down on it. But taken as what the game is and what it's not, I still really like that, and I'm looking forward to a Starfield 2 if the water hasn't been poisoned too much by people who, again, rightly so, didn't click with it or didn't like it.
That's a much wider thing, is like, what the hell is Bethesda going to feel like under Xbox? Because obviously we know now that Todd Howard, like, you know, put a lot of time into Indiana Jones, and that's just been recently shown off as well. So I wonder what it's like when he gets back into the next game, be Fallout 5 or whatever it is. We're in the top three territory. My number three is RoboCop Rogue City, my friend.
No way!
Oh my God.
No way!
RoboCop Rogue City was my game of the year for a bit.
Holy hell.
Oh, dude. Like, I'm a sucker for execution of a vision. Like, I'm a sucker for a team of creatives who clearly had fun making something, who didn't have to bow to some weird corporate whim to put a bunch of monetization options in there. Like, just make a game that is budgeted well, it plays well, it has, like, a really, really fun writing. In this case, it's inspired by, obviously, the RoboCop movies, but the general feel of, like, 80s action movies and early 90s action movies. Give me an excuse to indulge in that stuff. A really fun physics model. It's just so solid. And it's, like, it's not only is it extremely well written, they've got... the dude that played RoboCop, whose name I'm blanking on now.
No, it's not Peter Weller. Is it Peter Weller?
Say Peter Weller. Either way, they got Mr. RoboCop himself back to do the voice. You do little therapy sessions where you're answering questions and multiple. There's loads of multiple choice stuff in here. Dialogue options where you're deciding how much of your humanity do you want to lose to becoming RoboCop. There's a bunch of the game's kind of told in acts, so there's various different mini stories that you take part in. There's stuff to do with who you're going to elect to be the next mayor in the town, and whether you want to be like endorse the guy as RoboCop or speak truth to power and whatever. Those little things intersperse these sort of small open world segments that happen where you're going and doing smaller crimes in the city, you're helping the average person, and that changes your street cred and how much people trust you, and like there's all that stuff. But then in between that, you get these really cool just first person shooter, you know, not necessarily on rails, but really meaty shooting segments where you can grab enemies and throw them across the levels or throw them into each other. Everything's gory AF. You have the RoboCop vision, so you're like, you know, nailing headshots and everything. It's just so good at exactly what they set out to be. And it's just so well made. And also it's on Unreal 5, so it looks gorgeous.
Nice.
Like, it's legit absolutely stunning. Like, I mean, some of the stuff, some of the NPCs maybe don't live up to the environmental design or how good the RoboCop model is, but I just can't deny how bang, just absolutely beat for beat perfect it is. Like, it's so good. It's way better than it has any right to be. It's way better than Terminator Resistance was.
Right.
Same developer.
Yeah.
It's such a step up, and nowhere near enough people played it. And it's just like, I just loved it. It was such a throwback to a 360 era of game with modern technology, and just they went above and beyond with the dialogue choices and everything else.
That is so surprising, because when they released, you know, the initial gameplay trailers over the course of last year, I was excited for it when it was first announced. I thought this could be good. Then I saw the gameplay trailers and I just kind of thought, this looks rubbish.
Demo well.
No. Yeah, I thought, like, this has not sold me on the game. Then the reviews came out while I was off and everyone was saying, you know, you need to kind of play this. This is an underrated gem. I didn't realize it was going to be third of the year material, but everything you've said there, it sounds way bigger and way more robust than what I was expecting or what I'd gleaned from the gameplay trailers.
They massively undersold it.
Yeah, I'd seen, like, you know, some of the first-person shooter elements. I'd seen the fact that you had to solve, like, these crimes and, you know, pick up clues and whatnot. But that sounds like, that sounds meaty. That sounds like they've nailed a, like you said, a vision there.
Yeah, and also, like, it's really funny. Like, they get the sort of, like, sardonic black humor of RoboCop, like, especially because it's set in between, I think it's between one and two. But you get all these little mini missions, like, you know, you've got a bunch of hoodlums outside like some dude's shop and they're playing music too loud and you can talk them down or you can just punch right through the radio and be like I stopped the crime or whatever or you're throwing a guy in a jail cell and then RoboCop's like sleep tight or whatever it is and it's just like they just kind of get the goofiness of the character. There's one thing you can do when you're back at the police HQ where you can stand at the front desk and just take like people's queries because they're reporting crimes.
Amazing.
And you can do your dialogue choices through them. There are some hilarious and macabre AF responses to what some people's crime scenarios are. But yeah, I didn't expect it to be like just so fun and immersive. The music's brilliant as well. There's like a whole in-game band that like play sometimes and their music is in the game and it's just like, yeah, man, I absolutely loved it. Also, you can pick up motorbikes and just throw them at people.
I do like to
which
do
is,
that.
It's great.
You can do that in Hulk Ultimate Destruction as well, which is really good. Nah, man, if I've got nothing else from this two-part podcast that we've done, it's a solid recommendation for RoboCop, which now I am absolutely excited to play.
Trust
Can't wait for that.
Ewan Patterson dove in and he absolutely loved it as well.
Really?
Yeah. It's like, there's a bit of a leaden feel to the combat because you're just walking around as RoboCop. You're not jumping, you're not running. You are RoboCop. But because that, if you think about a standard first-person shooter controller setup, there are so many buttons dedicated to like running, dashing, sliding, whatever it is. If you do away with all of that and then make those unlockable abilities that you get, like a there's like a cloak that you can get and like a armor and stuff like that. It just, if for whatever reason, it frees it all up where it's like, this is a very unique feeling first-person shooter. And maybe it takes a little beat to get used to your more restricted movement, but there's a power to it. And you, the footsteps when he moves, like it's just so immersive. Third-person cutscenes, first-person gameplay is a great mix for immersion.
I can't wait. Dude, actually, it's good. As soon as Payday comes around and as soon as I'm finished with Baldur's, that's absolutely getting bought and played.
Please do. What was your number three?
Speaking of, my number three is Baldur's Gate 3. This is going to be one that I might look back, like I said at the start of the podcast, in a year's time and think, maybe that should have been higher. So I need to clarify that I'm not even finished the game yet. I'm barely in Act 3, so I haven't even had a bunch of the payoffs to like the character arcs and whatnot. And if this was like a list for the website, I wouldn't put it on because I haven't got to the end. But I've played 80 hours of it and
you know whether it's got quality.
Even within those 80 hours I already know that even if it like gave me another 40 hours of pure badness, the worst game I've ever played in my entire life, it would still be higher than everything else I put on here because I've enjoyed this so much. Baldur's Gate, like we were just talking about, was on the back foot for me, but as soon as I jumped in I thought, wow, this is going to be something special. In the opening hour, you're talking to a brain that's been pulled out the skull of a man that is now sentient. And I thought, it's got little legs. I was like, I wasn't expecting this, but I'm down for it. And I hope you got more where that came from. Unfortunately, it really does have more where that came from. It kind of reminds me, I know you were in many other people have kind of compared it to old BioWare games, which I can totally see. And I love that kind of strand of its DNA. But the game it reminds me most of, actually, is The Witcher 2. That was another game where I'd heard so much about a franchise, but that was my jumping in point. And it's, yeah, it's a little rough. It's not as polished as like a big AAA game, but it has such a sense of place. It has such an interesting world. And it kind of just throws you in the deep end in a way that is initially a little overwhelming, but then you kind of come to appreciate because there's so much richness to it. And even just kind of like the way you're walking around these, they're not hub areas, but like sort of isolated open, mini open worlds almost. Reminded me a lot of The Witcher 2. The way you can make massive decisions and branch the story off kind of like how you did reminded me of The Witcher 2. Along with the interface and stuff. And it just kind of has that kind of what I would describe as like a hardcore RPG DNA to it that CD Projekt Red that got them famous to begin with and allowed them to make The Witcher 3 and then later on Cyberpunk. You know, the game just gets better the more I play it. The characters are so interesting. They have such fascinating stories. It's so cool to get to know them. Just spending time in the camp is almost as exciting as, you know, walking around and exploring. Having finally got to Baldur's Gate itself is such a great payoff. I love how distinct the different areas are that you visit. You know, like you were talking about there in Act 2, where it's like this dark, foreboding place that you have to kind of figure out what the hell's going on. And a lot of, like, the enemies that you meet in that area that you can talk to are kind of, like, Bloodborne enemies, yeah. Did you mean
that guy that's half man, half spider?
I did.
He's a good lad.
Half man, half spider. There's like a crazed surgeon in there. There's a bunch of like weird occult people. That area was so up my street. And yeah, it just gets better the more I play it. Like, I do think that some of the gameplay, it surprised me to how not janky it is, because I know it's got so much praise for being responsive to your actions, but there were so many times early on where I didn't know if I was like just breaking the game.
Right.
Because the game wasn't saying like, oh, well done for completing it this way. It just kind of would tick a box.
It just keeps going.
Yeah, and it would keep going. And I'd go back and talk to people and they wouldn't really have much to say. They'd have like a line and I would think, oh, have I done this right? You know what I mean?
That's
it
the
was
thing.
Difficult to get out with that headspace. And I still kind of got it now a little bit. Minor issues on a big experience where it's like, talk to this person, confront them, and then I do, and then like the game isn't recognizing it because I obviously have to come back later, and I'm kind of like, I don't really know how to proceed without breaking something. But the fact that it's this ambitious to begin with, and the fact that it does account for so much is amazing in and of itself, that those minor quibbles have not really mattered over the course of 80 hours in the way that I thought they might.
Well, the fact that they maintain that veil of how are we doing this is like, that's the pure video game magic that the likes of Skyrim used to give us, an old BioWare, Knights of the Old Republic or whatever, old school BioWare stuff, Neverwinter Nights and everything. This is the nearest to that feeling that I've got from a game in a long time, where I'm like, I actually can't even comprehend the matrix of video game decisions that are behind the scenes, the various checks and balances the game's doing to serve me this story, me and you'll talk about it, but like the way that my Act 3 came together, I didn't think anything could be salvaged from the way that my game was.
Right.
And then it found a way to do all these cool things where I was like, this is brilliant. I think sometimes, like you said, there are certain checks that you need to hit, like certain main quest checks or whatever it is, that then makes the game do a big overall check on who you talk to, whatever, and then you get new dialogue and things like that. But the fact that you're not thinking about that, the fact that the gamified aspects of it aren't that obvious, lets you get in that like immersive headspace and just drink everything in.
Yeah,
like you're not thinking about the game design side of it.
No, you're not. I think that's why those few examples that I have stick out so much, because I'm not thinking about it so much that when I suddenly am,
when it reminds you it's not magic, it's like, God, okay.
Yeah, and it only happens a few times, but that's probably why I'm being more nitpicky on those elements than I would be in like a BioWare RPG or a bloody Bethesda RPG, you know?
Totally. And also Starfield reminds you it's a game every time it has a loading screen.
Yeah.
It's just that it's very obvious. But yeah, I had a couple of times in Baldur's where I had to just look something up because I had a specific thing where an item I had to pick up was on a bookshelf, but I had to trigger the opening of the bookshelf in a different way for it to show up, like stupid stuff like that. But overall, I said this in the main What Culture Gaming ranking, where I was like, I said it before, like, I'm just glad that we got this.
Yeah.
Like some games, you're just glad to have them in your life. And especially in the modern industry where it's just all over the place and so many things are on fire and 10,000 people lost their jobs last year.
Yeah.
The fact that Baldur still got over the finish line is kind of a miracle.
I'm not the arbiter of like taste or anything like that. But what I would say is if you're one of like the five people out there like me who hadn't played this game because, you know, you thought it wasn't for you, I definitely recommend giving it a go because like I was saying, you know, it has all of the elements that don't necessarily appeal to me on a I must play this level. And similarly, I've played almost every hour of my 80-hour experience so far with my girlfriend who's just watching and like, you know, enjoying both the combat and the exploration and making decisions and stuff. And again, similar to me, like that, it's not her thing at all. Like she doesn't even like watching like Mass Effect or Bethesda games because she finds some of like the dialogue boring. She's not into fantasy. She's not into turn-based combat or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And she's been as gripped as I am just from watching it. So yeah, if you think you're not interested, honestly, if you don't want to jump in at full price, fair enough, but I'd give it a go at some point because it might turn you onto an entire genre. like it's done for me.
Mm-hmm. I was going to do a stupid segue here and be like, well, maybe this would be a slippery slope that would get you into my number two. This is such a stupid subjectivity card.
Go on.
My number two is four games at once. I'm doing Final Fantasy Pixel Remasters, my friend. Otherwise, it would have just been most of my top 10. So my number two is Final Fantasy Pixel Remaster for 1, 4, 5, and 6. However, if you want me to pick one,
yeah,
pick four.
Four.
Maybe five.
You know what's hilarious, man, before you get into the specificities of this? As someone who was loudly and proudly talking about how much the industry was plagued by remakes and remasters and safe ideas, it's hilarious to see you have at least two remasters on this list.
Yeah, I mean, they're different conversations. I think the more that a studio leans on like full remakes like RE4 or whatever as their new thing, the amount of money that gets put into them. I know where you're going. That grinds my gears in a way that just making legendary games available doesn't. Like, we've been waiting for a console version of Final Fantasy VI for the entirety of it, you know, since the PS1 days.
Right.
And then especially getting, you know, touched up versions of Final Fantasy 1, 4, and 5. They've been on handheld for a while. Square Enix went back in and touched up a lot of stuff here, made sure the translations are correct for the scripts and everything, overhauled the music, put a bunch of things in here that let you speed up, you know, world travel. You can turn off attacks if you want, random encounters if you just want to get to the next place. Quality of life things, but they really help with revisiting classics from the 90s and the 80s. Yeah, I'm not going to talk about them too much. I just absolutely love my time with them. I love my time with old school Final Fantasy so much that I just kept going from one game to the next, and yeah. I love my time with all of them. Shout out specifically to 4 and 5.
Yeah, well, tell me why 4 is the one that like sticks out of all of those experiences that you
4's got such a great tone. Like, 4 is the one that opens with you playing as a bad guy. You play as a dude called Cecil who's like just been responsible for butchering this like little kingdom of people to retrieve one of the stones that they were keeping. And it's very on the nose. Like, the game opens with you having committed the act, going back to the Empire, your own kingdom, and all your dudes are like, I don't know if we should have done that. That was a bit strong. And it's like, no, it's what the king wants and everything else. And the music's really like foreboding and it's gray. And then it kind of just goes from there. It's all about Cecil's redemption over time and his best friend, Kane, who's like a different Dragoon warrior, who's like, he's like his best friend, but it's like, can you trust him or not? And there's a lot of back and forward stuff like that. The storytelling's all over the place, but it's not that far from Tolkien and it's not that far from just a grand adventure, which is one of the things that I love the most about Final Fantasy. I love a good party of characters, and the characters here are so much fun. And this game's version of Cid, there's always a Cid in Final Fantasy.
Yeah, I remember you saying this.
The Cid in 4 is hilarious. He's great. I love the ship that, I love everything he does, and the ship that you get and the that he helps make for you is great. I just had such a great time with this story that's all over the place. I will shout out 5 as well, though. Final Fantasy 5, everyone talks about the job system that's in there, that they've never really recaptured this job system, which is the specific thing where you equip different abilities, you grind on them, and then you unlock them, and then you have them forever, and you can combine different types of them so that by the end of the game, you've got all of these incredible combos of different abilities, different class abilities, different magic abilities. So you just end up with this really great party that is entirely yours. From what I'm told, I'm reliably informed that Final Fantasy X-2 and one of the sequels to 13 brings parts of that back, but that's a level of Final Fantasy I've not gone to yet. I'll get there. I'm replaying Final Fantasy X at the minute right now. I'm just about to fight Unalaska. But that whole Final Fantasy V, to me, lived up to the hype. It was actually 6 that I was a little bit disappointed by, considering how much people talk about that game.
Right.
Still a gorgeous game, but I was more blown away by 4 and 5. And going back to Final Fantasy 1, where it all started, I know they've overhauled a lot of it, but the music's still gorgeous. I love that they let you pick any class from 4 different characters at the start, and you make your party up of like 4 different types of character. It's totally, it was like 1983 or 4 or something. It's an old-ass game. But it is remastered, it is touched up and everything. I just had an absolute blast with it. They're so charming. And
best way to play those games?
Oh, dude, yeah. I mean, I have all of them on Switch. Like, it was just, they were my train games, they were my sitting in bed games. They were most of my summer was just playing Final Fantasy. I already talked about how I had a year of Final Fantasy last year.
Yeah.
But it was because of all of this and just not getting sick of it at all. If you're on the fence or you're curious about Final Fantasy 4 or 5, 5 takes a little bit longer to get going. But the actual mechanics of 5 are like series best mechanics.
We always talk about entry points into franchises and how so many of them have been lost over the years because games just aren't as accessible as they should be in terms of, you know, being able to buy an old game or appreciate a previous installment in a franchise that has, for whatever reason, gone away. So to have these now readily available across all the consoles, it's cool, man. As someone who's, you know, got into Final Fantasy with the remake and has always wanted to at least see what's going on with those older games. Mm-hmm. I like that now I can, and I don't just have to go and play the many versions of Final Fantasy 7 or 9 or whatever it is.
If you ever, you'll never do this, but if you ever play Final Fantasy 4 or 5, I would love to know what you thought of them. But that was my number two.
My number two is a game we have talked about, so I won't, again, dwell on it too much. But it's Alan Wake 2.
Beautiful pick.
Good Lord, what a game this is. This game was so good that it arrived in a period where I actually wasn't playing games, and then I decided, no, I need to play this thing because everyone was raving about it. You know, as you know, I think I even put it as my most anticipated game of last year. But even I wasn't expecting the absolute crazy amount of praise it received in the reviews when they dropped. So I needed to see what they had done. And I love that it's a... how would I describe it? It's a substantial sequel, and it's a meaningful sequel. Mm. And what I mean by that is it doesn't just kind of play the hits, or it doesn't just play it safe. It does the exact opposite. Mm. It gives you consequences for the actions of the previous games. It evolves the story. It changes it. It puts our characters into new situations while introducing new ones that were really fascinating. I love the way it deepens the world. I love the confidence in the storytelling. Mm. My favorite parts of Control were the live action segments, so it's so cool to see how much of this is live action in a way that is really well shot, really well acted, really well performed, and is creepy and is weird, but it manages to justify it. You know, it's funny looking back at something like Quantum Break, which obviously had live-action cutscenes as well, part of Microsoft's TV initiative, where the future will be a combo of live-action and games. And it was all right, but it was kind of weird to see how far they've come since then is incredible, because the live-action stuff is just as good as the gameplay itself. I think I mentioned when you were talking about Alan Wake 2 that, for me, Saga was just as interesting as Alan, and it got to the point where I was actually more interested in her story and I was prioritizing her levels more than I was Alan's. But yeah, I just think as a vision, it is incredible. As something that is tailored to my own personal tastes, it is exactly what I wanted, a nastier, more horror-focused version of this franchise. I love the way it cribs from Twin Peaks The Return, which I did briefly mention as well, but in terms of taking a protagonist you know and love and kind of making them a little bit darker, making the stakes that little bit higher, great. And the only thing that stops it from being number one is the combat, which got a little bit old and, you know, wasn't as satisfying as I expected from a Remedy game, unfortunately. It's just, it was only that element that literally stopped it from being number one, because I wanted, with all of my being, Scott, to put this as number one, because in terms of originality, in terms of what it means for the industry as a whole, like, I just want, I love it as a game, and I love it as where it's arrived within a year of releases that, you know, arguably have played it incredibly safe.
And it's like, I love it as a statement. It was just like, Remedy have gone through a lot across the last few years. They finally got the Alan Wake IP back. They did some contract work for whatever that first-person shooter was, Crossfire X,
yeah.
And it was like, what the hell are you guys doing? Well, you're funding Alan Wake 2, and it works for the greater good. This was the thing, Alan Wake 2, the general feeling of authorship throughout it, where I was like, Sam Blake's better than Hideo Kojima. Sam Lake deserves the Hideo Kojima reputation, like, by far. Like, this is a dude who is actually thinking things through and is actually nailing various thematics and is dedicating the every single thing. Like, I love the fact that all the audio in it, all the songs that were written for it, and all the TV adverts that were made for it, they're, like, custom for the game.
Yeah.
They flesh out, like, some character motivations and realities of what was going on in the background and the, you know, everything that was happening in Bright Falls with all the NPCs that are in there. That's a level of curation and authorship that only Remedy can do, at least right now. And like you said, like, in a year that was mostly quite safe, like, we got lots of great games, but I loved how much they pushed the boat out. I'm so curious about the sales, because it didn't have a physical release, and when it launched, it didn't, Mark Piscatella, I forget the name of the site that he writes for, tweeted that it wasn't even in the top 60.
No.
And it's like, I hope that it picks up over time. Obviously, it got a big showcase at the Game Awards. That musical number, as someone who's been with Remedy since the beginning, involving Poets of the Fall, the band, who I have a tattoo of because of how much I fell in love with their music and Max Payne 2. That was a thing when I was playing that last year where I was like, this is actually surreal that they've managed to do this and go this long. And also, shout out to James McCaffrey. Dude, like, passed away last month or the month before, but a legendary voice actor giving his last performance in Alan Wake 2. Like, every aspect of the Remediness of this was next level.
His performance in this, I think, is so low-key moving or full of pathos. Like, he's playing an intentionally exaggerated detective in a pulpy story, not too dissimilar to Max Payne. But, yeah, without spoilers, the way that character goes and the things that he's involved in a sort of meta way, just like... Yeah, like the performance that backs it up allows it to transcend what could have been very one-note or one-dimensional. Like you said, the remediness of this game is etched to another level. And with the sales in mind, I'm just scared we'll never get anything like this again. It does, again, remind me of Twin Peaks The Return, not just in terms of content, but in terms of how it was made. That was similarly a complete miracle. You know, David Lynch went in, said, I want to make Twin Peaks season 3. Showtime said, we don't have the money for what you want. It looked like it was going to fall apart. He went back in, somehow got more episodes in negotiations, made it. It was this esoteric niche thing that did not pull big numbers, but it was so cool that you had this director who had a vision and managed to get the resources to see it out in the same way that Sam Lake and the rest of Remedy did with Alan Wake 2, because you can slag it off, you can say the combat isn't as good as it should be, but you can't say that it isn't exactly what it wanted to be.
No, and I think, like, obviously right now where Remedy are, they have the Northlight engine. Like, they spent the last few years building their own game engine, and they have a multiplayer game coming up. Like, they've talked about, they have the Control 2, we know they're doing that, which will be a follow-on from where they are at the minute. And so they seem pretty confident, with the next few years.
I don't know what you think about this, but you know how it blends, obviously, live action and gameplay. There were certain times where, you know, I was controlling Alan around the streets of New York, and the way it was lit and just the sort of silhouette of him and the way his hair was rendered, it obviously didn't trick me into thinking it was live action, but it felt close.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like, they managed to make it work in a way where I would just stop and look at the screen and think, that looks like a frame from a film.
Totally.
And not that games have to be movies, but I'm talking just in terms of pure rendering power in the way that they have managed to nail the art direction in a way that makes it genuinely look lifelike, despite some of the crazy things that are happening in the game.
Yeah, there's some bits where you go to the Point View Hotel, I think it's called. There's a scene with Alan and a guy called Thomas Zane. There's a lot of... cutting back and forward, where you're showing Matthew Peretta's or Ilkavili's face, and that stuff, when you're going back and forward, where it's like, that's the real him, then it's the game him, then it's another character, and then it's back, and that stuff, that's the most where I was like, I actually can't tell which one's which right now. But yeah, just so much confidence, I think, is one of the key words. My number one, speaking of confidence, is Final Fantasy 16, my friend.
Oh,
a game that I waxed on about RoboCop before, but Final Fantasy is the other thing that I just enjoyed every single second of. I got the platinum. I just got every single drop out of this thing that I could. I devoured the DLC. Absolutely loved it. And it's like, me and you did that spoiler podcast on it.
Yeah.
Where, like, I, like, obviously hold up the thematics as one of the biggest reasons I absolutely loved it. I'm all for anime storytelling tropes where I'm literally punching the face of division or whatever it is. If there's a being that embodies the idea of a lack of confidence or whatever it is, and I can punch that thing in the face, I will, for the betterment of humanity. And I love the way that Final Fantasy 16 goes overall. It's just, I absolutely love the combat system. The bosses are the best bosses of the year. Love Ben Starr's performance as Clive. Shout out to Ben Starr. My friend Ben Starr, absolutely lovely meeting the man. And the whole presentation, the whole package was absolutely spot on. I get that some people didn't like it, and it is a huge departure from what people associate with Final Fantasy, which couldn't even be more obvious when you go back to the pixel remasters, where they came from and how far away that is from Final Fantasy 16. But to me, it didn't really matter. The thematics are in line, like the environmentalist messaging that's there. So many callbacks to Final Fantasy 4, which I realized retrospectively going through 4 afterwards. Just everything from the Dragoons to the overall setting to the tone. Like, there's a lot of it that is Final Fantasy 4. But yeah, I absolutely loved 16. That would be my game of the year.
You know what, man? Like, similar to Alan Wake 2, that is another game that you can have criticisms with it, like I certainly do, hence why it's not in the top 10, but you can't say that it doesn't execute a vision. Like, it is singular in what it wants to achieve and the story it wants to tell and the direction it wants to take the franchise, and I can only applaud that. Like you said, there were so many elements, like the boss fights, that I just thought were, you know, game of the year material. I thought it nailed so much the world that it brings to the foray of the characters and the way they are voice acted. Not only Ben Starr, but Ralph Ineson. I thought
he's
someone who doesn't even have any connection with Sid the character. He made me care about Sid.
One of the best
in
Sids.
This. It was a joy to explore the world. And I would love to spend more time in it if they did a Well, I know they're obviously doing DLCs, but if they did Final Fantasy 16 too or anything like that, I would. It's a world that I would like to explore more.
Give me a Gav spin-off. What is your number one?
My number one, it's a very Scott and Josh number one each, I think. Mine is Resident Evil 4.
Yeah.
It could never have been anything else. And it's funny, man, because Resident Evil 4 for me has stood up to heavy scrutiny by myself over the year. It was number one when we did the mid-year check-in, and since then it's been knocked off this top spot about four times. Starfield knocked it off, Baldur's Gate knocked it off, Alan Wake 2 knocked it off, but ultimately I just came back to this game. And
part how many times did you play through it?
Seven.
Yeah. Seven.
Part of me didn't want to put it at top because it is a remake, but man, if Jedi Survivor is how you do a sequel, this is how you do a remake. You know, it works for both returning players and new players. The way it kind of immediately plays with your what you expect Resident Evil 4 to be, I just found a breath of fresh air when you go up the bell tower in the village, and that's a spot where you could cheese the opening section in the original game, and now you just crash through it and you're brought back down to Earth. Amazing. I think from that village fight, I knew I was into something special because I said in the podcast we did way back when, but that is a fight I've done so many times before. I've played the original version of that 100 times over the years, showing it to friends, replaying it myself. And the fact that they managed to make that not only feel fresh, but as intense as the first time I played it back in 2008 when I eventually got around to Resident Evil 4 is incredible. I love the changes they've made to the story. I love the art direction. I think as a third-person shooter, it's different to the original, but it's still as impactful. Like, it's not as snappy as the original was, and you have more freedom of movement, but it still manages to feel like a survival or horror experience, probably even more so than the original did.
Oh, yeah.
I love it, and the reason it's number one and the reason I keep coming back to it is that it is literally the game that keeps on giving. Like, I thought the first run through on hardcore difficulty mode, 20 hours I put into it, I thought that was a five-star experience, but then I went back for more to get the platinum. Then Separate Ways came out, which just made it even better. And then the VR version of it came out for free, which made it even
literally
better.
Literally living in Resident Evil 4.
Literally was, man. It was like they just kept, like, they were bribing me to make it number one because they just kept giving me this great content that bolstered an already five-star game. Mm-hmm. Don't have enough good things to say about it, man. To me, I've said this before as well, but Resident Evil 2, I understand why people think that is a better remake. To me, this blows that out of the water just in terms of the changes they've made and how they've approached it. And it makes me excited to see what this team does next, whether it's an original game or whether it's another remake. I just can't wait, man, because Resident Evil's in such a good spot.
That's my overall thing, is that I love what it means for Capcom. I love the overall kind of project they've had internally of, like, let's get Resident Evil back on track. We experimented with a lot of action stuff across the 2000s, whether it be RE4 being influenced by, like, Metal Gear, and then RE5 and 6 being Gears of War-style things. And then I kind of left them in that weird no-man's land where they didn't really know where to go anymore. And then RE7 kind of brought the scares back, but at the end it was actiony again. And I just liked seeing them go, like, okay, let's have this one unified new timeline where we actually have enough information across multiple remakes to, like, unify all the different plot points. And you know, someone like Ada Wong actually has a more consistent through line from RE2 to 4. That's the stuff that I'm most interested in, is, like, where do they go from here? Because they're back up to that weird point in time again, where it's like, is Resident Evil an action franchise, a horror franchise, or its own feel? I hope they remake 5 and 6.
Me too.
I hope they have, like, the cojones to do that stuff properly, and try and bring out the horror elements and make it Resident Evil again. But yeah, I really enjoyed my time with it, but I didn't fall in love with it anywhere near as much as you did. I think I'm too much of a stickler for the original. I might have said that about the original Final Fantasies if I played them in the 90s.
Yeah.
Final Fantasy 6, 5, 4, or whatever. But because I was there when RE4 dropped, and I remember that feeling, and I love it. I still love stopping on the spot and having to defend your corner. I still love that
Me
stuff.
Me too, you know, yeah.
It's definitely what we said before about, like, certain limitations of hardware or design. Whether it was intentional or not, working in the favor of the overall design. I still love the feel of the original RE4 more. I don't necessarily like the leaden kind of slower feel of Leon in the new one, but it's not to knock it overall. Like, it's such a robust package overall.
Why I would describe this as the perfect remake is that I don't think it's, at least I hope not, Capcom, please don't do this. I don't think it's intention. I'm not saying that you're saying this, by the way, but its intention isn't to replace the original.
No, it's not. That's true.
What I love about it is that I can play both and get different experiences, but still two five-star experiences. And I hope that in 10 years' time, when I log on to the storefront of whatever console I'm playing at the time and I search Resident Evil 4, both still exist side by side, because I think it would be a travesty for this to replace the original, despite how good I think it is. And yeah, it's so unique and informed by that original that playing both side by side only elevates each other, I think.
Yeah, no, that's perfectly put. Yeah, when you go through the remake, it is very clear that they're not trying to replace, which is a really good distinction. Yeah, let's count them all down. I'm going to go 10 to 1. Like a Dragon Gaiden, the man who erased his name was at my number 10. Number 9, Gravity Circuit. Number 8, Theatrhythm Final Barline. Number 7, Alan Wake 2. Number 6, Baldur's Gate 3. Number 5, Street Fighter 6. Number 4, Metroid Prime Remastered. Number 3, Robocop Rogue City. Number 2, 4 different Final Fantasies, my friend. Final Fantasy 1. 4, 5, and 6, and number 1 is Final Fantasy 16.
What a list, and you know what? More crossover than I expected. Yeah. My top 10 is number 10, Liza P, number 9, Amnesia the Bunker, number 8, Zelda Tears of the Kingdom, number 7, Marvel Spider-Man 2, number 6, Star Wars Jedi Survivor, number 5, Stay Out of the House, number 4, Starfield, number 3, Baldur's Gate 3, number 2, Alan Wake 2. Just realised that's got, like, they've synced up really nicely. Yeah. Didn't need to do that. Number 1, Resident Evil 4.
That was a beautiful, beautiful year. That was the year that was. I think that's the longest we've gone on a subjective ranking so far.
I think so.
Which can be our new bar to hit. But now this has been the wind-up. Didn't do an intro when we started this. I'm Scott Tailford, that's Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tailford.
Always a pleasure to be heard by all of you, and we'll catch you very soon.
Bye-bye. Goodbye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.